MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Okay, and the good Dr. Ross Walker joins me this afternoon. Hello, Ross. How are you?
Hello, mate. I'm very well. Lovely to talk to you.
I've got a couple of listener questions. Let me see. Arnold. Hello, Arnold. Arnold wants to ask you a question about blood pressure, taking your blood pressure. Arnold said, could you please ask Dr. Ross Walker, am I best to take one test morning and night, or what about the machines that allow you, and I'm paraphrasing here, but apparently there are blood pressure machines out there that they will give you three tests over an average with, I believe, a 30-second to one-minute break in between, and then that gives you an average result of those three tests. Is that better than just the one test, is what Arnold is asking.
I think we're overdoing all of this. Firstly, a few principles I have about blood pressure measurements. Never take them first thing in the morning. The reason being is you go from very asleep to very awake. There's often a jump up in your blood pressure first thing in the morning, especially if you're not taking your pills at night. And so I say to people, wait till about 10 o'clock. So the times to take your blood pressure might be 10 o'clock 1 week, 3 o'clock the next week, 9 o'clock the next week. I've got some patients who check their blood pressures three times a day, and I tell them to get a life. I mean, it's just ridiculous doing that. You don't need to. No one has their blood pressure checked that often normally. So it's just doing it occasionally, once a week at the very most, just to see what it's doing. And you don't need to have it average over 5 minutes. What I say to people is to sit quietly in a room by yourself for 5 minutes before you even take it. So don't rush in from doing something and check your blood pressure, unless you have symptoms, of course. But if you just want to monitor your blood pressure, make sure you've sat quietly. Because what I'm interested in, what I call blood pressure reserve, which is what you can get down to when you're resting, not what your blood pressure is like when you're annoyed. So, for example, if someone has a screaming argument with their next-door neighbour and check their blood pressure during the argument, obviously it's going to be high. I'm not interested in that level. I'm interested in the best level, not the worst level.
The other night, I was checking my blood pressure, as I do on a semi-regular basis, and I was able to get a reading at 10 o'clock at night, after sitting down for a little while, of 95 over 68. Your thoughts?
And you're not on pills, are you?
No, I'm not.
No, well, if you can get down to that, that's where we all should be, but none of us are, because we were designed basically just to be hunter-gatherers wandering around a jungle with a spear, where the food was completely natural and not laden with salt, where we weren't drinking too much grog, and we weren't stressed out of our brain apart from avoiding being something else's lunch. So therefore, we live in a completely artificial society, which is flogged with salt, stress, grog, sugar, you name it. And people are getting belly fat, none of which you have. And so, therefore, you have a blood pressure that most of us would envy, to be able to get it down to that when you're resting. So congratulations.
Ross, what about this potassium salt? I've seen several articles of this potassium salt. And basically, the articles are saying it's good for you rather than bad for you. Is this just advertising and marketing, or is it fact?
No. There's a wonderful place in Sydney called the George Institute that have been doing all of these epidemiologic studies around the world. This recent study out of China looks, I think, I haven't got the figures here in front of me, but I think it was just over 1,600 people from a whole lot of different nursing homes in China, where they replaced table salt with a potassium salt and got a drop in blood pressure equivalent to a standard blood pressure pill. So the potassium salt, firstly, you're getting rid of the sodium chloride, which is bad for you, drives up your blood pressure, but you're replacing it with potassium chloride that actually drives down your blood pressure. So you're getting really two bangs for your buck by using potassium salt. So if you can get the potassium salt, I would certainly stress that. But foods that are high in potassium are strangely all the foods that we know are good for us anyhow, fruits and vegetables, whole grains, etc. These are all the stuff that has a lot of potassium, whereas all the processed packaged muck masquerading as food in a box doesn't have a lot of potassium, but has a huge amount of sodium.
And just think, for so many years I ate Nutri-Grain thinking it was the cereal and I was going to look like Grant Kenny.
Sorry, mate, that's just a myth.
Ray wants to know, Brent, could you ask Dr. Ross if he has heard of the new development in myeloma treatment? He said, I believe there is one, I'm a sufferer.
Look, with myeloma, there's a whole lot of new experimental drugs that are being trialed. For example, this is not new, this has been around for a while, there's a treatment that's a spin-off of thalidomide. So we know that thalidomide was banned many years ago because of what it did to unborn babies, but it's actually a very good treatment for myeloma. Now, there's a new drug called lenalidomide, which is like thalidomide, which does exactly the same thing. It has a high rate of putting myeloma into remission. But in terms of the latest monoclonal antibodies and other immune therapies that are around, I don't know the specific latest stuff, but there's always stuff coming out for myeloma.
And just quickly, Trent wants to know your thoughts on these booster vaccinations for COVID. He wants to know, should he think about it or not?
Look, I interviewed Professor Catherine Bennett on my show last Sunday night. And in my view, she's the most sensible epidemiologist in Australia and gives, I think, very guarded views on all of this. But she's still a strong supporter of the RNA vaccines, and I still have my concerns. On Sunday night, I'm interviewing Dr. Asim Malhotra, who's coming to Australia to do an anti-RNA tour. And I was asked to actually speak at one of the forums on this, and I said, well, I'm not against vaccination, so no point having me on the card because I won't do it. So I'm giving Asim a forum to talk about his views, and we got some pretty filthy text messages when we were interviewing Catherine, because she was saying that if you are in the high-risk group, then yes, you should probably have a fifth vaccine. But the high-risk group are the very old, the very sick with other conditions, and the very overweight. But what she was also saying is that the vast majority of us have been exposed to COVID over the past 12 months or have had four vaccines. And so our hybrid immunity is probably very good anyhow. And what I'm personally waiting for is to see what happens as we go into the colder months. Will we see a recrudescence of COVID? If we do, I may consider having a fifth vaccine, and I will probably have Novavax because I still have those ongoing concerns about the RNA vaccines. Mm-hmm. But again, the reality is only 0.2% of people who've been vaccinated with any vaccines have had a serious event to it. And they go, people go, well, that's still 0.2. But it's nothing like the people who have reacted badly to COVID. So 10% of people who get COVID get long COVID. So we're not talking about a benign disease. So you certainly don't want to get COVID. So if we see the case numbers really starting to go through the roof, I'll go off and have a fifth vaccination. If, however, we just see them grumbling along like we are at the moment, I think I've had four vaccines and I've had a dose of COVID, so I think I've probably had enough, and my antibody levels are probably good enough to combat any further variants. Because let me make the point, there have been no new strains of COVID since Omicron, which occurred, I think it was late in October 2021 when we first saw Omicron. There's been no new strains. There's been a whole lot of new variants of Omicron, but no new strains.
Okay, let's talk about a healthy lifestyle, and it has been found to cut breast cancer reoccurrence, which in turn cuts mortality rates.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. This was 1,340 chemotherapy-naive patients who had either stage 1 up to stage 3 high-risk breast cancer, and they found that those who had the best lifestyles versus those who had the worst lifestyles, as judged by an objective index of all this stuff, with the best lifestyles, there was a 37% reduction in recurrence and a 58% reduction in death over a two-year period from breast cancer. And the best information comes around smoking cessation, because it's interesting, when people are diagnosed with cancer, they, especially lung cancer, they say, oh, well, I'm smoking and it's not going to make any difference now. I've got cancer, so I'll just keep smoking. No, wrong information. It shows that if you have a diagnosis of cancer, by stopping smoking, you can markedly improve your outlook by regular exercise, by having a lot of fruits and vegetables, and getting rid of sugar, sweetened drinks. These are the people who had the best outcomes in these studies. But what I talk about all the time, Brent, the five keys of being healthy: no addictions, good sleep, good eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours of exercise, and most importantly, happiness. These are all the things we should be working on, whether we have cancer or not, and this study is just another study to back up that information.
All of these studies continually mention the effects, the adverse effects that stress plays on the human body. Yep. And it's not just cancer, it's many other things as well.
Everything. And look, I say this all the time, that all disease is genetic, but it's your genes that loads the gun, then your environment that pulls the trigger. And in 40 years of practicing medicine, I have never seen one person who had a heart attack, a stent, a stroke, a bypass, who wasn't under some form of stress at the time. So stress causes no disease at all, but it is the great precipitant if you have an underlying predisposition for this.
We're still talking on the subject of cancer. Pharmaceutical giant Moderna is hoping to fast-track a groundbreaking mRNA vaccine to make it available to cancer patients in Australia. This is in reference to melanoma, is that right?
Mm. Yeah, so when you think of vaccination, you typically think of preventing infection. But now there's this push to have these personalised vaccines, and Moderna are using the RNA technology against this thing. So what they do is they basically take the person's own tumour, map the RNA of that tumour, and then inject it back into people. So that this was a trial of 107 patients with melanoma. They had surgery, they had the tumour removed, they had the vaccine created based on their person's own tumour, and they compared a group who just had immunotherapy alone versus immunotherapy and vaccine. So the standard immunotherapies are things like Keytruda, which, let me say, President Jimmy Carter had a diagnosis 10 years ago of advanced melanoma that had spread to his brain. He was given this Keytruda. He's still alive because of it. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about adding this to things like Keytruda. And they found that in the people, this is an 18-month study, a 44% reduction in recurrence when they compared immunotherapy alone versus immunotherapy and vaccination. So the vaccines are adding those extra benefits. And what I interviewed a fellow on my show on Sunday night about all this, and he said that by 2030, there'll be vaccines for most of all the other cancers that are around the place, whether we're talking about lung cancer, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, glioma, all of these things are being tested, and respiratory illnesses, autoimmune diseases. So there's a lot of ways that now the RNA technology is being worked. And people say, oh, I don't want this RNA stuff because it caused all the problems with COVID. No, I think it's because the reason why the COVID RNA vaccines were so controversial and caused a few problems for some people is because the COVID spike protein itself is very pro-inflammatory. And when you do an RNA copy of that and use that in a vaccine, you have a pro-inflammatory vaccine. But we're talking about for a whole lot of other conditions where it is slightly different using the same technology, but still a different vaccine.
Currently, 8 million patients with Parkinson's disease in the world, and researchers look to possibly be in the process of discovering a potential cause of Parkinson's disease, Ross.
Yeah, this is really interesting because up to now we really don't know what has caused Parkinson's disease. And over the last few years there's been talk about this particular junk protein called alpha-synuclein, which many researchers have felt grows up through the vagus nerve to the brain from the gut. So what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas, so to speak. And so as this alpha-synuclein goes up from the gut to the brain, it gets concentrated in an area of the brain called the substantia nigra, which is the area that controls movement, etc., and which is what happens in people with Parkinson's. What they found is this particular gut bacteria called Desulfo vibrio is in high concentrations in the guts of people with Parkinson's disease, and this particular bacteria aggregates this alpha-synuclein. So it could be that that Parkinson's disease is yet another gut disease, and we're hearing so much about the gut microbiome. And they found in some experimental animals, when they kill the Vibrio bacteria, that the symptoms of Parkinson's disease in these particular animals who are genetically primed to develop Parkinson's actually improves. So it could be in the future that one of the ways we assess for Parkinson's is to look at this gut bacteria and to start killing the gut bacteria with targeted antibiotics, and we may improve people's Parkinson's disease. Now, again, this is experimental stuff. Please don't ring my office and ask where they can get the antibiotics for this, but it's being investigated in a couple of labs around the world. One in Helsinki, one in Hong Kong are doing some very elegant work along these lines.
In medical news today, talking on a mobile phone for 30 minutes or more per week is linked with a 12% increase in the risk of high blood pressure. I mean, most people listening to us would talk for more than 30 minutes a week on a mobile phone.
And most people listening to us would have high blood pressure. So there you go. Now, I'm not saying blood pressure is only caused by speaking on mobile phones, because there was a lot of blood pressure around a long time before we had mobile phones. This is just yet another potential issue with using the phones for too long. And we're not really sure why there would be a link between speaking on the phone, and it's a mobile phone, not on a handheld device at home. So, interestingly, they also found that whether you used a hands-free device or not, it still caused the rise in blood pressure. And this is another interesting thing. More than 30 minutes per week, a 12% increased risk for blood pressure. But if you've got strong genetic factors, so a strong family history of high blood pressure, and you spoke on the phone, a 33% increased risk. And this comes from a thing called the UK Biobank data, which a lot of studies are coming out from now. We're just talking about just over 212,000 people followed for 12 years. So it's a huge study. Average age of people is 54, and they found the longer you spoke, the higher your blood pressure risk.
Young men with cannabis, as in marijuana use disorder, yep, have an increased risk of developing schizophrenia. We've talked a little bit about this before. No surprises here?
Oh, yeah. There's the marijuana party that wants to start legalising it all over Australia, as the lunatics in the US are doing as well, suggesting that marijuana's harmless. They're just using it occasionally. It's not going to hurt you at all. Well, I'm sorry. The evidence just is not there that it's harmless. And as you know, I'm on the board of a company that's developing medical cannabis, which is completely different. We're not talking about medical cannabis is something you smoke, and we're not talking about medical cannabis as something that's got huge amounts of THC in it. It might have a little bit. But when people smoke stuff that is highly concentrated THC, they're saying that a third of schizophrenia in men aged 20 to 30 can be attributed to marijuana use. A third of cases of schizophrenia. It's really quite scary. And it can happen in women as well, and it can happen in older people. It's just the group where it's really concentrated is young men aged between 20 to 30, which is probably the population that use the most marijuana, higher rates of schizophrenia. And also, look, within 2 hours of smoking a joint, you increase your risk for a heart attack 5 times. So we're not talking about something that's harmless. One joint a week can increase your risk for infertility.
Don't smoke.
That's it. Don't smoke anything.
It's always a delight to talk to you each and every Tuesday afternoon. We thank you for your time. Our time is up. We have to go. I'm sure you do too, to go and heal the sick.
Absolutely. They're waiting with bated breath.
Thanks, Ross. Okay, I'll talk to you next week. See you later. Bye-bye.